all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counterpower in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on. A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. This it will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this era need him. Why? Because according to the government.
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected, parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi in the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohammed Fazari, from Khartoum, Sudan, city of Omdurman.
p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in eight phases, ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in past by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens.
The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
What is one of the cornerstones of having a strong family life? It's the relationship between a husband and a wife. And this topic of ihsan, it's something which very much is a key to being able to solve a lot of the problems that appear within the family. Because ihsan means that when one spouse is in some way being, in some way either violating the rights of the other spouse, or they're bothering them, or they're annoying them, or they have some faults, ihsan means that rather than taking an aggressive approach, rather than responding to bad with bad, we respond to bad with good. We respond to bad with forgiveness. We respond to bad with overlooking. We respond to bad with love. And even though it might seem counterintuitive, especially at the moment, especially when, you know, something's happened and we feel that, like, you know, how could they do that to me? It might seem counterintuitive to respond with good. Actually, if we look at the way human beings operate, in many cases, responding to bad behavior with good, with ihsan, with beauty, with compassion, it's actually going to lead to a better outcome at the end. There are many times when people would come to the imams with their problems, and sometimes they would have family problems as well. And they would say that, okay, look, this is my spouse and they're treating me like this. And they would tell them, well, you know, if you can't just work it out, then be patient. Forgive them. Overlook it. They would tell them about the reward for somebody who does so. In hadith, it's quite amazing that somebody, for example, if there's a husband who is patient over the bad akhlaq of his wife, then his reward will be the reward of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam. Nabi Ayyub was somebody who faced a lot of difficulties in his life. When there's a wife who is patient over the bad akhlaq of her husband, then her reward will be the reward of Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, right? She had the biggest tyrant as her husband. And I know that brothers and sisters have heard these traditions before, but we need these reminders. The way that family life works, and especially in the busy life that we live, oftentimes we forget about these, the higher akhlaq that we are called towards. Because we look at things in a very limited perspective. We see that, okay, right now, here and now, this person has done this to me, I have to respond with anger. I have to see what I can do bad to them. It's actually a disease where what happens is that, let's say one of the spouses, they do something wrong, so the other person tries to figure out how they can do something wrong to kind of hurt them. And then it goes, it's sort of like this war then. You know, like, okay, you threw an arrow, now I'm going to fire a gun. You fired a gun, now I'm going to drop a bomb, right? And then that becomes like, and then usually what happens is that after a while, things get patched up, right? And then things go along, but that damage has taken place. The children have also sensed that as well. And to go and repatch that again, it's sometimes very difficult. Why not avoid that in the first place? Again, ihsan doesn't mean that you don't take into account adl at all and you ignore the boundaries. No, there are boundaries, there are red lines. It's not the case that, for example, one spouse can tolerate the behavior of another spouse where it's causing them to commit haram. It's causing them to not be able to do their wajibat. That's not allowed. But reality is that there will be faults and there will be difficulties. Ayatul Bajad, in one, I believe it's from Ayatul Bajad, he says that a relationship with when you marry somebody, you're not marrying a perfect human being. And just like you have a rose which has so much beauty to it, so much incredible beauty to it, it also has thorns as well. And so when you are interacting with your spouse, you should know that at times you're going to be seeing those thorns. And the thorns are going to hurt as well too. But that doesn't mean that the beautiful part of the rose is not there. There was one time where a lady came to Ayatul Bajad and she complained about her husband's bad akhlaq. It's very interesting. So Ayatul Bajad wanted to, you know, explain to her this concept of ihsan and being patient, right? So he said that, let me tell you a story. So he tells us a story of this one wazir by the name of Asma'i. You know, in the books of history, there's a lot of stories where Asma'i, you know, he was a wazir of one of the khulafa of the Abbasids. But for some reason, he used to travel a lot and he came across a lot of different experiences in his life. So he tells her a story. I'm telling you this because I feel it's, you know, the fact that a great scholar like him would give that as advice for family life, it's something that we can take note of. So Asma'i one day was traveling in the desert. He was hunting and he got kind of lost, you know, and he ran out of food. So he's traveling in the desert and he's getting pretty thirsty and pretty hungry. So eventually he comes to this one sort of tent in, you know, in the wilderness. And he seeks permission of the tent, the persons in the tent. It happens to be a young lady who's there. And, you know, he says that, okay, I'm been hunting, I'm really hungry and thirsty, can you help me out? Give me some water. So she's hospitable, but then when he asks for some water, he notices that she's a little bit like sort of like a sense of anxiousness comes on her face. And she tells him, she says that, look, my husband hasn't given me permission to use the water for anything else other than those things he told me to. So I can't give you the water. I don't have rights over that. But I do have some milk and I had saved that milk for my own lunch and I'm going to give that to you instead and I'll just skip lunch. So he gladly takes it from her. He drinks the milk and he gets, you know, sort of, at least he's not like dying. And then after some time, you know, her husband comes back. And Asma'i, you know, greets him and then he's there for a bit. He's taking rest before he wants to move on. But he notices that this man is an ogre, right? The way that he's dealing with her is just terrible, right? She has patience. She is controlling herself. She's trying to show love. And here's this man and he is just laying it on and no respect and no regard. So after a time, he says that this is too much for me. And he just, you know, seeks his permission. He leaves the tent and he wants to bid farewell. And when he's going, he just has a comment for the lady. The man is doing something else and he has a comment for her. He says that, I don't understand. You know, he's treating you like this and you're so patient. Like, how is this? So she tells him, he says that, look, don't be a source of creating a conflict between me and my husband. The reality is that, yes, okay, I'm just paraphrasing here, that he is treating me this way. But after all, like, this world is short. We're here, sometimes we might be in a castle, sometimes we might be in a tent, sometimes we might be in the city, sometimes we might be in the desert. The point is that this world is temporary, and the hereafter is our ultimate destination. And I am acting on a tradition that I heard reported from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. Where he says that iman is of two parts. Half of it is patience and half of it is thankfulness. And so that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Now, that story is illustrative. It can be misinterpreted. It can be used as a way of justifying ogreish behavior. It can be used as a way of justifying injustice. That's not what I intend to do at all. It's not okay for somebody to trample somebody's rights. They are trampling their rights in this world, but in the hereafter, they're going to be affected much more than even the person whose rights are being trampled. It's not okay to disrespect. It's not okay to just take somebody for granted. It's not okay to crush their personality. If we want to be taking lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam and justice, then we should be taking lessons of understanding that human beings have all been created for the purpose of being the khulafa of Allah on earth. And when we deal with mu'mineen, we should be dealing with somebody who is attached to Allah, right? Who has more hurma and more respect than even the house of Allah. And Allah has said in tradition that there is nothing which brings my punishment more severe than when somebody takes and tries to gets into when they come and they attack one of my awliya, when they come and attack one of my mu'mineen, one of the believers. That's the gist of the tradition. So I don't mean in any way to justify that. That is in its own place. But when it comes to daily life, the reality is that it's not going to be perfect. The society we're in is one which says that, okay, if it's not going to work, then just leave it, just drop it, just move away. You know, assert your own rights, be your own person. Topic concepts of like forgiveness and kind of like, you know, being sort of passing over something and looking aside and forgiving and all these type of things, they're sort of not given a lot of prominence in our society. But Islam calls us towards ihsan. It's a better way of living. It's something which leads to more peace in life, and something which definitely in our society, in our families, and in our communities, we have to be able to observe this higher level of interaction, which is known as ihsan.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen شاكر ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercker movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absart to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon them the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemies' malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris. One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch, where what I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia, between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. president in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK, as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation? But the question is just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation. Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker than ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
The Israeli regime finally released Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras on Thursday. Al-Akhras had refused food for over 100 days in protest against his so-called administrative detention. He is now extremely frail, but says his prolonged hunger strike, which he ended on November 8th, has paid off. Al-Ahra says his freedom is the freedom of his people and an important win over the Israeli occupation. The 49-year-old Palestinian farmer from Salat al-Dahr in the north of the occupied West Bank began his hunger strike in July. His decision to refuse food was a bid to draw attention to Israel's widely condemned use of administrative detention. His hunger strike, which brought him to the brink of death, made headlines around the world, once again highlighting Israel's gross violation of human rights against Palestinian prisoners. His refusal to eat triggered a wave of condemnation of his administrative detention. The United Nations, the European Union, many rights groups and governments called for his release. Al-Ahras was one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates currently held in Israeli jails without charge or trial. Israel extensively uses its notorious administrative detention policy against Palestinians. That policy allows the regime to hold the inmates indefinitely without providing any evidence of wrongdoing. The notorious detention policy in Palestine is nothing new. It has been ongoing for many decades. It dates back to the British mandate and has since been used by the Israeli regime.
The British developed it to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement when Britain was the colonial power until 48. The Israelis have picked it up, they have refined it, they play cat and mouse with hundreds and hundreds of prisoners, as you say, detained without charge, and who are sometimes even taken to the very day of their release, sometimes even allowed outside the prison gates and immediately snatched, kidnapped and taken back inside for another 6-month period.
For Palestinians, spending time in Israeli jails is a common experience. Some estimates show around 1/5 of the total Palestinian population has gone through detention in Israeli jails since 1967. That's over 700,000 people. There are currently several thousand Palestinian inmates, including a large number of children, in Israeli prisons. Appalling conditions and harsh treatment are indispensable parts of the terrible experience. Many Palestinian inmates say Israeli forces tortured them while in custody. Many have also complained of medical negligence. Reports show inmates who suffer from dangerous chronic illnesses are only given painkillers. Meanwhile, poor present conditions are making incarceration increasingly dangerous during the coronavirus pandemic. For instance, dozens of Palestinian prisoners have tested positive for the highly contagious disease inside the Israeli prison of Gilboa. Those with pre-existing health conditions could easily lose their lives. Protests against unbearable prison conditions have grown in recent years, including several high-profile hunger strikes, but they have rarely forced Israel to take action.
We need to start telling their stories, because the story of the prisoners is the story of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. It's a central aspect of that struggle, and I think we need to tell that story. We need to organize in a way where groups in different countries around the world can focus on particular groups of Palestinian prisoners, men, women, children, and tell their story and tell the whole world the horrors that Palestinians suffer.
The international community has been pretty loud in condemning Israel's violation of human rights against the Palestinians, including the rights violations inside its prisons. But the verbal condemnation has done little to change the regime's behavior. This could have been much different if governments had used their economic leverage with Israel to pressure it to change direction.
Mohammed bin Salman. His name is now more conspicuously tied to the slaying of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi and spearheading the bloody war in Yemen. But that's not what he wanted to be known for in the first place. A few years before he came to power as the Saudi crown prince and the de facto leader of the kingdom in 2017, he established a charity by the name of MISC, or Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Foundation, a non-profit foundation with the stated goal of cultivating and encouraging learning and leadership in youth for a better future in Saudi Arabia. MISC was in fact central to the so-called MBS project, aimed at promoting Bin Salman as a compassionate leader who cares for the well-being of others. Much to the dismay of the young crown prince, MISC is now engulfed in a spate of scandals, including the Khashoggi hit. The foundation came under suspicion following a lawsuit filed in the U.S. last November, according to which MISC's former Secretary General, Badr al-Assakr, had interactions with two former Twitter employees, namely Ali al-Zabara and Ahmed Abu Amu, both accused of spying on private user data of some Saudi dissidents and passing it to Riyadh. The suit asserted that Assakr had provided gifts, cash payments, and promises of future employment in exchange for non-public information about Twitter users. The two employees, along with Ahmed al-Mutairi, who then worked for the Saudi royal family, tapped data from 6,000 Twitter accounts in the years 2014 and 2015. The aim was to identify, and needless to say, to punish some of the Saudi dissidents who would criticize the kingdom's ruling family on the social media platform. The three men all worked for Assakr, who was back then in charge of Bin Salman's charity foundations, with a small fortune in his pocket. But that was not the first and last time Assakr, who still continues to have a senior role at MISC, hit the headlines for his non-philanthropic work. Just a few weeks after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Safak ran the story that the Saudi intelligence officer at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul called Assakr four times the day Khashoggi was killed.
Mohammed bin Salman is not only the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, meaning that he controls everything from the functions of the state to murders that are carried out, assassinations that are carried out, to the charitable trusts. And we shouldn't be surprised at all that he is still busy trying to brutally murder people. Mohammed bin Salman has not been held accountable in any way for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and we're right now at the anniversary of that.
Critics say beneath the surface of MISC and gentle appearance of its former Secretary General, who happens to head Bin Salman's private office, lie dark secrets that dovetail with the Saudi Crown Prince's real image, not the one burnished by his spin doctors. In the words of director of Freedom Forward, Sanjeev Berry, the Crown Prince and his henchmen keep trying to present themselves in a positive light. Yet behind the scenes, they spy on dissidents' Twitter accounts and are willing to take a bone saw to anyone who disagrees with them. Initially, a number of big names like the United Nations, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg, Harvard University, and General Electric sealed partnerships with MISC. But in the wake of the Khashoggi killing, more of them, like the Gates Foundation and Harvard University, cut ties with it.
Mohammed bin Salman, since he came into power, has been trying to sell us an image of himself, like a Disney World version of a Saudi crown prince, one who is a reformer, one who is bringing his country into the modern era. But in reality, he is a brutal dictator who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who chops off the bodies of journalists, who imprisons women for speaking out against him, or for speaking out calling for their rights. And so, you know, he's trying to present this Disneyland image, but especially after Khashoggi's murder and looking at heroes like Lujain al-Haqloul, who remains imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, we easily see through him, see through this image, and see him for the brutal, bonesaw, misogynist dictator that he is.
The scandalous story of Misk reached its crescendo in August this year, when former Saudi intelligence officer Saad al-Jabri filed a lawsuit in the U.S., alleging that the Saudi crown prince plotted to assassinate him by sending a 50-person kill team, dubbed the Tiger Squad, a few weeks after the killing of Khashoggi. According to al-Jabri, Misk conspired with al-Sagar and bin Salman to covertly recruit individuals to serve as agents and who participated in the hunt for him on U.S. and Canadian soil. The hitmen were offered employment at Misk as a reward for aiding the Crown Prince and Mr. al-Sagar. Concerns about the so-called charitable foundation intensified in September 2017, when people from Misk repeatedly asked one of Jabri's sons for contact details of Jabri himself and his wife, as well as about their residency status in the United States.
So as Mohammed bin Salman is trying to paint himself as this modernizer, as this reformer, we are continuing to expose the Saudi regime for the brutal dictatorship that it is, for the war crimes that it commits. Saudi Arabia this year is hosting the G20 forum, but across the board, mayors of cities across America and across the world who have been invited are canceling. And they are canceling because of the imprisoned women, because of the brutal crackdowns on journalists, on dissidents, because of the brutal war in Yemen.
The Misk case begs this question. If Saudi officials can run spy rings, dismember a journalist, and dispatch a kill team all under the guise of a charity, what can they not do in an all-out military conflict like the Yemen war? Whether these are just the tip of the iceberg or not, Misk Foundation, first and foremost, embodies the Saudi duplicity entrenched in the kingdom's ruling family, where things are not really what they seem.
IRIB English Radio.